I say what ho, this is Brian, call me Achilles Gardner, coming to you from the Devil's Hole, aka Ramble on Towers Dungeon Studios in scenic, ever so pretty Hespel, Ontario. And you are listening to Ramble on Radio, episode 131. Ramble on Radio is, and I'm going to say this, the only Led Zeppelin podcast on this or any other known internets. Be sure to go to rambleonradio.com. for all your Led Zeppelin news, for reviews, and any links I might mention during the show. You can subscribe to Ramble on Radio through iTunes. And if you go to iTunes, leave a review. Go over there, even if you're there, getting whoever. Whatever you want to get from iTunes, pop over, leave a review on Ramble on Radio. It doesn't matter if it's good, doesn't matter if it's bad. One star, you have to leave a star. One star, three, five. However many you want, say what you want, but it helps other people find us. It helps the Apple algorithms locate the podcast and put us higher in their search rankings and that sort of thing. So it's, just go over, leave a review. You can listen to us on Podbean if you're on an Android phone. Podbean may be your podcatcher of choice. I'm on Podbean at I Am Brian, damn it. Listen on Spreaker, Spreaker. And if you're on Spreaker, be sure to follow Ramble on Radio. And also, we're now on Stitcher Radio. So, go to Stitcher, look up Ramble on Radio, and you can just listen to it as it comes up. Also, check out Ramble on Radio on YouTube, follow Ramble on Radio on Facebook, and at Ramble on Blog on Twitter. And yes, I said I'm the only Led Zeppelin podcast. Because, yes, there is a new podcast. There's a new guy in town. podcast called The Heart of Markness. You may want to check this guy out. It's okay. It's not, he's like I was very early on. A little rough around the edges, but not bad. However, he's kind of indicated it won't be a Led Zeppelin exclusive podcast, although he's focusing on live music. I guess he's a bit of a bootleg guy. So his first one was on the Copenhagen 79 show, which I'm going to have to go back and listen to it. He got me intrigued. I'm listening so much to the 77 shows right now, though, that... And we'll get into why in a minute. That I haven't had a chance to go and listen to that Copenhagen. I never really think much of it since you talk 79, you think Nebworth. But he mentioned the Copenhagen. He really likes the Copenhagen. Fairly good performance and a really good recording. So, and he is right, the recording was really, but then he played a couple of tracks on it. So, The Heart of Markness, you might want to check it out. The second one was about the ARMS tour. He's promised for the next little while it's going to be about Led Zeppelin live stuff. But it seems like he has some varied interests and he doesn't want to lock himself into Led Zeppelin. So, I'm going for now with still the only Led Zeppelin podcast. If he looks like he's going to stick with the Led Zeppelin, then I'll go with the original Led Zeppelin podcast. No big deal. I can do both. But anyway, yes, go check out Heart of Markness. Even if he hasn't answered my email, congratulating on this fine show. So this week in history, the Laurel Pop Festival in Laurel, Maryland, July 11, 1969. Also July 11, 1983, the Principle of Moments was released. Well, last week we talked about 35 years since Robert Plant's first solo album, Pictures at 11. Principle of Moments, his second album, was released a year and a week later, and that was July 11, 1983. 13th was Live Aid. I posted Live Aid... Dave Lewis had posted a YouTube video of Live Aid, and I reposted it on the Facebook page. And funny, and I kind of said, it really wasn't bad. It gets disparaged as not a good performance, even by the band members themselves. And I kind of commented on that and said, you know, it wasn't that bad. There were moments. Clearly, they were struggling at times, but not badly. It really wasn't awful. Then I kind of pointed out a couple of things. Watch for this. And I really meant it like, you know, whenever I see something like a live video or something, I kind of look for the quirky things. You know, I get, oh, he's going to hit the right note. That's what he's supposed to do. Usually. sometimes an exceptional something happens and you point that out. So there was a couple of quirky things I noticed. Robert Plant comes in at the end of Stairway to Heaven. The last part comes in while Page is still soloing. He doesn't let him finish. That was one of them. You could see, like, Phil Collins never rehearsed with the band, right? And it was Tony Thompson, I think, was the other drummer. And you could see at parts where he's kind of talking over to Phil Collins as they're playing. And he's kind of coaching them through the songs as they go, that sort of thing. Just little things. I thought I didn't like the bass in Stairway to Heaven. It was an odd thing, but I really noticed it was the bass really kind of gave the middle section too much oomph. And it's maybe just what I'm used to, but it just seemed to have a little too much oomph in that middle section with the bass kind of powering through that. Those are just a couple of things I noticed, and they weren't meant, but somebody said, oh, don't be so negative, it's a fine performance. I wasn't really being negative. I thought it was being positive, actually, but there you go. But anyway, it's on the Facebook page, the performance. Go check it out. It's not a bad performance. It's not what, and I watched it at the time. And we didn't think, I can guarantee you, we were sitting and watching it. I was at a friend's apartment, actually. What was it, 1985, so I was 22, still single. And I was at a friend's apartment, and we, you know, showed up with beer, and we drank, and we watched quite a bit of Live Aid from there. And it was good. And you know, we were excited that they might be coming out. They never said they're coming, right? It was the rumor. And of course, they held them out to the end. And there were some really dodgy performances at Live Aid. I kind of recall Bob Dylan with Ron Wood and Keith Richards, I think, came out, and it was not good. But what the heck? It was, people were doing stuff that day, you know? We didn't think, oh, Zeppelin was terrible. We thought, hey, for guys who haven't played together in 6 years, that wasn't bad. Agreed it wasn't perfect. It wasn't 1972, but it wasn't bad. All right, on this, on July 14th, 2011, JimmyPage.com was launched. And very shortly thereafter, this podcast, by the way. July 15, 1966, happy 51st birthday, Jason Bonham. July 20, 1969, Page and Peter Grant go see Robert Plant singing for the band Obstweedle at the Birmingham Teachers Training College. I've been reading a lot this week, pulling out all my books and going through some stuff, and I caught a bit of a bit with Plant talking about it. It was actually a really bad time because he felt Band of Joy was really quite good, and Terry Reed had taken Bonham away, which killed the band, and he was doing some oddball stuff, and he had some kind of, you know, he was doing like some crooning type of singing for whatever money he could make, plus Obstweedle on weekends, and it was a really, he kind of thought, this is it. And Page and Grant went to see him sing, and that wasn't it. And on the 1969, on the 21st of July, so that must have been 1968, July 20, 1968, Page and Grant go see Robert Plant. And on the 21st, 1969, the Schaefer Music Festival in Central Park, which the band played. Okay, this appeared today. Those who get these emails from Japanese bootleg companies. There has been talk for quite a while about a new Seattle coming. Seattle 75 coming. It's called Do Ek Machina, which is a literary term. I don't know why they're using it here. I think it's a term that people just kind of think is cool. But it means a major plot twist that saves a character. So this is Led Zeppelin, March 21st, 1975, previously unreleased Soundboard, Empress Valley label. The Soundboard Revolution series presents, and this is straight from their advertising, by the way, for the very first and only time anywhere, the legendary longest ever USA show. The following unique editions of the ultra-rare show are due for release soon. Ultimate Collector's Edition, promo box set, 3 1775 soundboard and 3 2175 soundboard, 100 numbered copies only. Now, it's worth mentioning, 3 1775 isn't the new soundboard, so they're repackaging an old one with a new one. The 7-CD mega rare box with OBI, I have no idea what that means, includes both Seattle shows in complete and perfect stereo soundboard. Each CD is housed in special paper cases inside exquisite ultra limited edition box. Only a few, $550. Extremely limited edition, complete Seattle 2-night stand box set. This 14-CD exclusive box with OBI includes both previously unreleased Seattle 32175, the 31775 show in complete and perfect stereo soundboard, with the added bonuses of remastered audience sources for each show to provide two completely different listening perspectives for each night. Each CD set is housed in a special paper case with OBIs. The set is enclosed in an exquisite limited edition box similar to Thunder Down Under box set, $650. And the deluxe limited edition box set, this 8-CD deluxe box with OBI, includes previously unreleased Seattle 32175 show in perfect stereo soundboard with added bonus of remastered audience source of the show. Each CD set is housed in special paper cases with OBIs. The set is enclosed in a beautiful limited edition box similar to History Lesson box set, $400. That's just coming out. And of course, if you are like me and you're just kind of free ride on these things, once they're out, they actually hit. they hit. People pay $600 and then put it on the internet for free for really fast. It's kind of weird actually. They'll be on the internet very soon. And we'll probably, once that comes out, I'll talk a bit about it. I'll dig into that claim that it's the longest ever US show, and maybe we'll play a couple of tracks off it. We'll see. All right. Tonight's topic, by the way, is the 1977 tour. 40 years ago now, Led Zeppelin was actually in the middle of, and nearing the bitter end of, well, their American experience, which includes, which is the 77 tour. 77 tour was not a happy occasion in Planet Zeppelin, for a variety of reasons, which I'm going to delve into. But mostly because, well, drugs had entered the equation in a big, 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 big way. And we often talk about Page and the drug problem, but the fact is the drug problem was all over the show. People who kind of got close to the show and were used to this sort of thing were surprised at the amount of drugs the roadies were taking. That was even, you know, the road crew was... It's hard to get things done when you're that out of it. So anyway, this is not an off-the-cuff. This is going to be long. But let's talk. We're going to do, this is part one. We're going to do two parts. And then I'm actually thinking I'm going to do a third, maybe even a fourth part on the 77 tour. Next Monday will be the last day. So basically a week from now will be the 40 years since the last American concert. So I really plan to hit, to have one ready to go for that for Monday next, so that We can just hit the anniversary. But then after that, I'm thinking I might do one or two shows on actually the bootlegs, because there's a lot of bootlegs from that 77 tour. There's a lot of music. Some of it's good. It's a tour. Again, it's disparaged somewhat, but it had its moments of real brilliance too. And so we'll... I'm thinking we're going to get three, maybe four podcasts in the next month or so out of the 77 tour. Believe me, I know more about that tour than I ever thought I would know now. I've been reading like crazy on it. And I still have some finishing up to do on the last part of the tour. But anyway, here it is. And that's a script, folks. That's what you hear there. Anyway, Led Zeppelin hit the ground, not running, not with Robert Plant's bad leg, but certainly in motion in 1977. They booked time at Manticore, Emerson, Lake & Palmer's converted theater in Fulham, just outside of London, to rehearse. Day one, the band attacked a new song, Achilles' Last Stand. There would be no easing into rehearsals. Achilles is the most complex song, one of the most complex songs the band ever recorded, if not the most complex song. Never mind performed. And Page had to figure an arrangement to let him recreate as best he could 14 guitar overdubs that went into the recording. Yet, they started with it. I remember reading a review of one of the LA shows at the time. It was in Hip Raider, one of those, what's her name? I forget now, but I think it was like in Hip Raider or Circus or something. And they were talking about the tour, and they were at the LA shows. And Keith Richards was there, and he commented, "There's only one guitar player who could play Achilles' Last Stand, and that's the guy who's on stage tonight." That was, it was a complex song to play, and it was mesmerizing to watch. They also rehearsed Candy Store Rock and Nobody's Fault But Mine from the new album, 1976's Presence, although Candy Store Rock never made it to stage. Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You and Custard Pie were also rehearsed but never performed. And a little side note here, I see Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You as being rehearsed, and I realize, by mid-70s, by 76, 77, Steve Howe was using a guitar stand for his acoustic guitar on Roundabout. Alex Lifeson was using one for Closer to the Heart. Probably, I'm sure, I have no doubt other guys were using the stand. So it makes you wonder if Page tried out an acoustic guitar stand for Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You. At that time, and or of course, maybe they triple necked. Maybe they just used the triple neck. So here it was: Led Zeppelin was returning to America, the tour that was to go to the U.S., Canada, South America before hitting England for a festival show in. And I read it, and I forget it now offhand. I believe it was August. It was to be the band's 11th American tour. The tour was originally supposed to start February 27 in Fort Worth, Texas. However, Robert Plant developed laryngitis a few days before opening of the tour, and it was postponed for a month until April 1st. Needs to be said here, the official reason for the postponement was laryngitis. The suggestion exists that Plant was actually overly nervous about his foot, although he was also boasting that he trained with Wolverhampton. He was boasting that he trained with the Wolverhampton Wanderers to build up his leg strength before the tour, according to Mick Wall in his book, When Giants Walk the Earth. However, all the gear had been shipped. Tour canceled, but all the gear had been shipped to the States. It was a month with no rehearsing, no practice. Here's how the original opening leg was supposed to look. Fort Worth, Houston, Baton Rouge, Oklahoma City, Dallas, Tempe, Arizona, San Diego, LA, Toronto, Montreal, Dayton, Ohio, Birmingham, Alabama. Sorry, that's Toronto, Ontario, Montreal, Quebec, Dayton, Ohio, Birmingham, Alabama, Atlanta, and Greensboro, North Carolina. All the shows were rescheduled except for Toronto, Montreal, and Dayton. And here in Toronto, we have never forgotten or forgiven, I must say. Everything from Toronto forward actually ran past the opening date of the tour. So Toronto was actually an April 1st date. It could have, as they started the tour on April 1st, there's no reason they couldn't have done it. Again, we remember. But they rescheduled it all. And there is, by the way, That was never a released itinerary, and there is some dispute as to the actual planned dates of the city. Lisa Robinson, that's the name I was over earlier, from Hip Parader, had a different itinerary that she had published. So there is dispute on this. The tour would start on April 1st in Dallas. It would run until mid-August. It would encompass almost 50 shows, 43 or 4, I think, is the actual number of shows it was set to go. The shows themselves ran 3-plus hours, 15 songs plus 2 encores. It was an extremely big and extremely ambitious tour. And the question is, was the band up to it physically? Besides Plant's Leg, he was taking painkillers daily and would throughout the tour, and spent a lot of his free time resting in his suite watching TV. Plant may have actually been the least of the worries. Page and Bonham had bad heroin habits. Page's especially was affecting his performance. Besides heroin, Page was frail and thin. Accounts suggest he was not eating solid food, but living on a diet of banana daiquiris and vitamins to keep whatever strength he had up. Ironically, that show would be canceled because he had food poisoning. Bonham himself was bloated. Besides the band, Richard Cole also had a heroin problem and had been more or less supplanted in the organization by John Buffo Bindon, of whom, believe me, we will get back to. Bindon is a big player in this story as it goes along, but not quite yet. Page, Bonham, and Cole were also using cocaine very heavily, as was Peter Grant. Grant was no longer the same Peter Grant, no longer in full control of either the organization or himself. He had a massive cocaine problem. He was deeply, deeply depressed about the breakup of his marriage, which was mostly due to his drugs, and about he was also depressed about his weight and very sensitive on the subject. Grant and Cole both suffered from cocaine-induced paranoia. This was not something that was going to end well. Gone as well was the Danny Goldberg media relations of 1975. In 75, they made a point of reaching out to the media, trying to make an accommodation. In 77, journalist Stephen Rosen was given rules of engagement on tour by Swansong press officer Janine Safer. Here they are. Never talk to anyone in the band unless they talk to you first. Do not make any sort of eye contact with John Bonham. This is for your own safety. Do not talk to Peter Grant or Richard Cole for any reason. Keep your cassette player turned off at all times unless conducting interviews. Never ask questions about anything other than music. Most importantly, and understand this, the band will read what is written about them. The band does not like the press or trust them. The tour was to be, as I said, massive. Shoko brought huge sound and lighting rig, complete with large TV screens for the stadium shows. And each member of the inner circle had an assistant. Each of the band members, Peter Grant, even Richard Cole had his own assistants. What was once a tight-knit organization was now a very fractured group, with two distinct factions. Page and Bonham were always late. Plant and Jones were waiting around looking at their watches. Even the plane was sick. The Starship, the plane the band leased for the previous two tours of the U.S., was grounded a few weeks before the tours started when one of the engines nearly came off in flight. Or, as Dave Lewis put it in the concert files, when it had engine troubles. It was grounded with engine troubles. Nice understatement, my pal. My pal Dave with his understatement. They went instead to a 707 owned by Caesar's Palace, the casino, called Caesar's Chariot. It was, in fact, just as luxurious as a Starship, but it didn't have an organ. Nobody minded, nobody cared, nobody was inclined to want to play an organ on the plane this time around. The band was not told the reason for the change, as some of them had actually become nervous flyers and, well, the engine nearly fell off the last plane was not likely to soothe them. The tour would run in three segments, with a 2 to 3 week break between each leg, in which the band flew back to England. The first leg would take the American Midwest, the second to the South, plus New York, and, kind of weirdly, L.A. And weirdly, LA, because the next leg would start on the West Coast. It would head and then dip south and east to New Orleans before heading to Chicago. I'm not sure on this, but I'm going to guess the Chicago show was a rescheduled show from the one where Paige had food poisoning. Plus Buffalo and Pittsburgh. Here is the tour dates. Leg 1, April 1st, Dallas. April 3rd, Oklahoma City. April 6th, 7th, 9th, Chicago. And 10th, Chicago. April 12th, Bloomington, Minnesota. April 13th, St. Paul, Minnesota. April 15th, St. Louis. April 17th, Indianapolis. April 19th and 20th, Cincinnati. April 23rd, Atlanta. April 25th, Louisville, Kentucky. April 27th and 28th, Richfield, Ohio. Which is a half hour south of Cleveland and a half an hour north of Akron. And April 30, Pontiac, Michigan, which is Detroit. Leg 2. Then they would take a break. They would take an actual about a 2.5 week break here. Well, 18 days, I'm going to say. Leg 2 ended, started May 18th in Birmingham, Alabama. May 19th in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. May 21st in Houston. 22nd, Fort Worth, Texas. 25th, 26th, 28th, and 30th in Landover, Maryland, which is Washington, D.C. May 31st in Greensboro, North Carolina. June 3rd in Tampa. Then, 6 nights, June 7th, 8th, 10th, 11th, 13th, 14th in New York. June 19th in San Diego. And then another 6 nighter, June 21st, 22nd, 23rd, 25th, 26th, 27th in L.A. This would lead to another break until July 17th when they return to Seattle. For leg 3, Tempe, Arizona on July 20, July 23rd and 4th, Oakland. July 30, New Orleans. August 2nd, Chicago. August 8th, Buffalo. August 9th and 13th, Pittsburgh. However, things would turn bad in Oakland and turn absolutely tragic in New Orleans, with the last 5 dates, New Orleans, Chicago, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, and Pittsburgh, canceled, and Oakland on July 24th being the last ever show for the band. But I'm getting ahead of myself. The set list would be similar to the 75 tour, as the Earls and the Earls Court show that happened in May 75. Matter of fact, it would be closer to the Earls Court probably. But there would be changes, as noted above. Killy's Last Stand and Nobody's Fault But Mine were added. Dazed and Confused was removed, as was Whole Lot of Love for the first part of the tour. Paige would instead do a guitar solo section that encompassed the theremin and the violin bow. As well, Paige used his blue and white Dan Electro guitar to perform White Summer and Black Mountainside, which is a return from the earliest he did in the like 70, 71, 69, 70 tours, that sort of thing. And those led directly into Kashmir. So we went White Summer, Black Mountainside, right into Kashmir, and it created a 20-minute epic song. Over the Hills and Far Away and Heartbreaker were added to the set list in New York for the first time. Both were performed since 73. Some other changes. Jimmy Page was now smoking on stage. Chain smoking, I recall reading at the time. Probably a result of his heroin use, and that's my guess. He also introduced the white dragon slash poppy suit, the white suit that had a dragon up the leg and the poppy and stuff. Read this on the internet today. There are suggestions it is, in fact, a, quote, heroin suit. It's a white suit representing the white powder, red poppies, which is, you know, the poppy, and a black dragon chasing the dragon. That's an internet meme. I read it on the internet today. Never had heard it before. It's you want to laugh at it, but it's an interesting, considering he was pretty stuck on the stuff. It's an interesting suggestion, I suppose. Besides new stage attire, he also had some new equipment. Page now used a brown Telecaster, representing no doubt brown paste. Yeah, bad joke. The Telecaster was used for 10 years gone and had a B-bender in it. B-bender is, for you non-guitar people, it's the only way I can say this. If you're a guitar geek, you know what a B-bender is. If you're not, the strings on a guitar, They're like the strings on a piano. Best descriptions, but like the strings on a piano. They are stationarily mounted. They don't change. What changes is your fingerings on the string. So as you finger the string, you change the note. But what if you could change the string? What if you could tighten the string? As it's tighter, it gives you a higher note. As it loosens, it gives you a lower note. And take an elastic band and, you know, everybody did this as kids, right? Pull on the elastic band and the note gets bing, 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 bing. So the B bender attaches to the second string, the B string. This is why it's called a B bender. And by pushing down on it's attached to the button that the strap attaches to. And by pushing down on it, you change the pitch of the string. So it gives you the effect of like a pedal. It's a very country effect, like a pedal steel guitar. And so he had in the Brown Heroin Telecaster. He had the B bender in there, which he used for 10 years gone. And quite magically. Yeah, would use it in Whole Lotta Love. The best description of it in Whole Lotta Love, those little the little one note little slides throughout the song. Those are actually his B bender. Also uses it on Hot Dog, by the way. But that would be later. He also had a Martin D28, which he was using for the acoustic set, and a Gibson mandolin, which he used on Going to California, I think. As well, as well as his usually 57, his Sunburst Les Pauls, he had now a Cherry Red Les Paul, which he used on Over the Hills and Far Away and a few other songs. John Paul Jones had some new instruments too, a 12-string Ovation. For the first leg, I understood they brought 10 Years Gone out because he had this new triple neck guitar. But according to Dave Lewis in the concert files, for the first leg of the tour, he used a 12-string Ovation guitar for 10 Years Gone and Battle of Evermore, and a Harmony mandolin for Going to California on the first leg of the tour. On leg 2 and 3, he had the triple neck, which had a mandolin, a 12-string, and a 6-string. It's a custom-made guitar by Andy Manson. And if you look up Andy Manson, he's still making guitars to this day. He used a stand-up bass for Black Country Woman, Bronyard Stomp. He swapped out, he used Fender basses for years. He got two made by a company called Alembic. One was an 8-string. And you can hear the difference when you hear a good recording of Achilles' Last Stand, for instance, or something. You can just hear that the bass just roars. In a way he never really did with his old Fender. He also now had a black Yamaha CP70B grand piano with him. And he would overuse that on No Quarter. Jones also sang Sandy Denny's second vocal part in Battle of Evermore. It's not good. It's not pretty to listen to. And in respect, not the best idea. And here's what he had to say about it. I'll never know how I agreed to that. Years later, he's quoted as saying. Robert Plant himself plays harp on Nobody's Fault But Mine, which absolutely shines. And that was the intro here was from, I think it was Cincinnati. I forget what I pulled out. Or maybe it was one of the Chicago's. I think it was actually one of the Chicago shows. But that was Robert Plant's harp solo, and that's why I wanted to try and give you some of that. Absolutely shines. He's so good at that. It really is one of the highlights to me. As by the way, you know, Achilles as well as one of the highlights of the tour. It is absolutely magical what they do with that song on live. And you know, they only pulled 2 songs off of Presence, but boy, they both were good. And they both came across really well. Plant's also starts using a harmonizer, which would split this. What a harmonizer does is it basically you sing into it and it creates a harmony line with your own voice. So it splits your voice and then it changes one of the voices to create effect of a second singer. So he's now in harmony. And you hear it at the end of Rock and Roll, for instance. He actually goes, he kind of does it a little differently. He goes, lonely, 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 lonely. And then time. And I'm not a singer, so forgive me for that bit. But he has a harmony part. It's like two voices going. And, you know, if you don't know about vocal harmony, think of the bands The Wait, right? Or Twist and Shout, which is all it really does. What the vocal harmony does is really kind of add those other lines in. Anyway, it was the harmonizer was controlled by Benji LaFave at the mixing console. And actually, amongst Zeppelin aficionados, it's controversial. A lot of people didn't like it. A lot of people think Plant never needed it. All right, they opened, as noted, April 1st, 77 in Dallas. And here's the set list. Set list, Song Remains the Same, / Sick Again. They go into those together. Nobody's Fault But Mine, In My Time of Dying, Since I've Been Loving You, No Quarter, 10 Years Gone, Battle of Evermore, No Quarter. 10 Years Gone, Battle of Evermore, Going to California, Black Country Woman, Bronyard Stomp, White Summer, Black Mountainside, / Cashmere, Moby Dick, or as they're now calling the drum solo segment, Over the Top. Page's guitar solo, Achilles' Last Stand, Stairway to Heaven, and for an encore, Black Dog and Rock and Roll. As noted, there was an acoustic set now, the first since 1972, with the exception of Earl's Court. They did acoustic set in Earl's Court, but otherwise they hadn't done one since 1972. The truth was, the acoustic set is largely there because Robert Plant needed a break, needed to sit down and rest his leg. And we see pictures of the acoustic set from 77. He often has his leg sticking out in front of him. The first show would be the only time Black Dog was played on the tour. It was replaced in the encore first by Trampled Underfoot, starting in Fort Worth on May 22nd. And then starting in Fort Worth in May 22nd, the encore becomes a shortened version of Whole Lotta Love, which that would, May 22nd, be the first time Whole Lotta Love is played. And when I say shortened, you lose almost the ending. They do verse, chorus, done. Then they go directly into Rock and Roll. They don't do the middle section with the theremin and the big, and they don't do the the guitar part, the guitar, little guitar solo, and way down inside. They don't do all that stuff, is gone. It's just the part of the song, bang, and then they go into Rock and Roll. And that would be used almost exclusively for the rest of the tour. And if I recall, Nebworth, they also used that version of Whole Lotta Love. The first leg saw four dates in Chicago. The first leg saw four dates in Chicago. The first one, Page showed up, and so it was the third show of the tour. The first one, Page performed dressed in Nazi regalia, wearing an SS officer's cap and jack boots. And we kind of think of, well, these guys did this stuff in those days. And it was actually, there were people there at the time who said, are you joking? There were people within the Zeppelin entourage who were actually a bit embarrassed by it. So it's, you know, some things are beyond the pale, I guess. Nowadays, you'd be absolutely crucified for doing something like that. But even in then, it was even them days, you know, there were people who wouldn't have been impressed. And there were people within Led Zeppelin's camp who were not amused by it. Two nights later, on April 9th, Page fell ill and needed to sit in a chair to play 10 Years Gone before leaving the stage with severe stomach cramps. The official reasoning was food poisoning. But since Page was assumed not to be eating, food poisoning actually seemed unlikely. And the assumption obviously being that it was a drug problem, is a drug-induced problem. In Cincinnati, on April 20th, a fan died when he fell from the venue's third level. The band didn't know this. It was not widely reported even at the time, but it did happen. In the last show of the first leg of the tour in Pontiac, Michigan, 76,000 fans attended, breaking Led Zeppelin's own attendance record for 1973 Tampa show for the biggest audience for a single act. And the important note there is for a single act. They would do, for instance, their last shows in Oakland would have more people, but they weren't the only act on the venue. So, you know, like Woodstock would have more people. But for just one band, that's 76,000 at the time was a record. Musically, other than some movements of the songs in and out of the encore, not much changes, except the introduction of the Rover makes it into the opening between Song Remains the Same and Sick Again on a number of occasions, three or four times. And that's only in the first leg, doesn't happen again, and only happens a few times. And after the first leg was over, the band flew home for two and a bit break. All except Paige, who went to Cairo for 4 days to do some Egyptology/Aleister Crowley research with Mick Hinton, who is the drum technician. On May 12th, a few weeks later, the band were all in attendance when they were awarded with the Ivor Novello Award for their colorful, quote, colorful and energetic contribution to British music. Ceremony was held at Grosvenor Hotel in London and presented by TV comedian John Inman. Never heard of him. But I'm sure there's lots of Brits out there. Oh, I love John Inman. But yeah, I wouldn't have heard of him. That's okay. You guys have never heard of Rick Mercer. I'm quite sure. The second leg would kick off in Birmingham, Alabama on May 18th. And the second leg would be much more eventful both on and off stage. In Houston on May 21st, fans went on a rampage after a show causing $500,000 damage. 40 people were arrested. The next night in Fort Worth, the band was staying at the same hotel as Bad Company. And guitarist Mick Ralph joined the band on stage during the encore to play Jerry Lee Lewis's It'll Be Me. It'll Be Me would also be an encore in L.A., but without the help of Mick Ralph's. In Washington, Maryland, Peter Grant met with a Russian delegation. He was negotiating to have Led Zeppelin perform behind the Iron Curtain and invited the delegates to the show. Put a bug in John Paul Jones's ear, who played Rachmaninoff in his keyboard solo during No Quarter. He added some Rachmaninoff for their benefit, and apparently they were much impressed. May 26th in Landover, Robert Plant, during the acoustic set, Robert Plant kind of broke into a verse of dancing, not much, just a little tiny bit of a verse of Dancing Days before Black Country Woman, Bronyar Stomp. It's significant. He kind of fools around with a lot of songs on this night, as he does sometimes while the band's, you know, while John Paul Jones is getting out his upright bass and stuff, he's rhyming off some songs. But this one's significant because a month later in L.A. they would actually play Dancing Days in that spot. Only one time during the tour, and we'll talk a bit about that, I guess. But yeah, they play it, and it's actually really cool sounding. Dancing Days works good as an acoustic song, actually. Greensboro, North Carolina show the next night began 1 hour late, and Plant from the stage said, sorry, we left somebody in New York. Wonder if that's true and who. The next night was in Tampa. It didn't go so well. It went not well. As 70,000 fans attended the show, more than the 56 that attended Tampa last time, but it was canceled after three songs. Peter Grant had a rule. Zeppelin always had a backup rain date for outdoor shows ever since Stone the Crow's guitarist Les Harvey was electrocuted on stage in 72. Grant was the manager of Stone the Crow's and was at that show. Stone the Crow's, by the way, were Maggie Bell's band. On the plane to the show, Richard Cole noted that the tickets were rain and shine, in strict violation of Zepp policy. They rescheduled for the next night after the cancellation. But when the show was canceled, fans rioted. The police tear gassed and so forth. Zeppelin was then banned from authorities from putting on the show the next night. So the Tampa show never went off. They never would play Tampa again. From Tampa, it was to New York. Over six nights, 120,000 fans saw the band. Over six shows over eight nights, 120,000 fans saw the band in New York City at Madison Square Garden. The band was always at their best for New York and L.A., which is basically where they would go to from New York. And this tour is really no different. The set list would start to get a little fluid, and the playing would start to get a little better. Heartbreaker would be played for the first time since 73. They would play it four times on the tour and three times in New York City. Over the Hills and Far Away also made its first appearance, also since the first time since 1973. It would actually replace In My Time of Dying in the set. And for the rest of the tour, from this night forward, there would be a haphazard alternating of In My Time of Dying and Over the Hills and Far Away. The two songs were never played on the same night. But it wasn't exactly, you know, the reason I say haphazard alternation is it wasn't a case of tonight, then tomorrow night we play the other, then tonight. Sometimes it got three in a row, sometimes it got 4-0. And actually, by the end of the set, it was always Over the Hills and Far Away. Robert Plant didn't want to do In My Time of Dying, actually. After the 75 tour, and after I guess his accident stuff, he kind of said, you know, maybe that song's got some bad mojo, and he didn't want to do it. Obviously changed his mind, because they played it for most of the tour. But it did get phased out by the end of it, and this was the starting of the phasing out here. Over the Hills and Far Away would replace it in the next month, sort of thing. After New York, New York was a triumph. New York was always a triumph. And the set list would really start to get played with in L.A. a week later. They would really go into a different mode in L.A. But that's next week. Next week, we're going to talk about L.A., San Diego, and everything in between. Tempe, Arizona is noted as the worst ever Led Zeppelin concert. And according to Led Zeppelin FAQ. And we're going to talk a bit about that. We're going to talk about the L.A. shows. We're going to talk about how it all ended badly in San Diego. And how it all ended tragically and awfully in New Orleans a day later. Hopefully that'll be next Monday, July 24th. We'll get that out. I'll get that out. I have most of my notes made, so it's just a matter of writing up a script and going from there. So thank you for listening to Ramble On Radio, episode 131. Check Ramble On Radio for notes on this week's podcast, Led Zeppelin news, reviews, and any links mentioned in today's podcast. Follow Ramble On Radio on Facebook, Google+, and at Ramble On Blog on Twitter. You could don't do Google+. You could subscribe to Ramble On Radio through iTunes. And don't forget, don't forget to leave a review. If you're in iTunes, leave a review. By the way, Jimmy Page and the Black Crowes, now available for downloading. So if you go to iTunes, buy Jimmy Page and the Black Crowes, one of the great, great, great albums, great live album from 2000, 2001. And while you're there, pop over to Ramble On Radio and leave a review. You can listen on Stitcher Radio and on Spreaker, Spreaker. Be sure to follow Ramble On Radio on Spreaker. You can also download it from I Am Brian Dammit on Podbean. And check out Ramble On Radio on YouTube. Thanks for listening to Ramble On Radio, episode 131. And we're going to finish off with, I forget the show, but Going to California from, I think this is from Destroyer, a rather famous bootleg of the time, which is, got to put my glasses on. I have it on. It's the only bootleg I ever actually bought until fairly recently. And it's on cassette. And it's just a Maxell cassette that some guy taped and sold for $20 out of his store. And I couldn't believe I got my hands on it at the time. It was unbelievable. And then I would listen to it in my car and go, really? This is awful. Not the band, but the sound. But I've since gotten quite used to bootlegs and I love them. But there you go. So April 28, 77, the destroyer, it's called, river in Cincinnati, Ohio. And I'm pretty sure this is what going to this is going to California is from this show. So you guys have a lovely, lovely week. Enjoy your summer. For those of you exercising this, have a good workout. And I will be talking to you next week. I will be back very soon. Have a good week, and thanks for listening. Thank you.